Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of great coffee that ships to your house or business in Canada or the States. They'll discount 20%, yeah, if you use the code. That's Toppin' Under Project, one big word, Fresh Arabica Beans. Fresh Arabica Beans! Order Spark Plug as you need or join the Autopilot Coffee Club. Choose half-calf, decaf, seasonal blend. It'll arrive in a week. It'll arrive in a week. Hank's needed spark plug on his uncharted desert isle. But he had coconuts. His buddy Wilson, too. A FedEx box that saved his life. What a movie star. Hank's loved hunt, but not the beachfront. Go to sparkplugcoffee.com right now.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hi, film freakazoids, and thank you so much for taking part in this podcasting adventure known as the Top 100 Project. Here in our 371st Ellis's Analysis, we'll be digging into as many of Castaway's crevices as we can, and we'll spoil those crevices. Oh, but in case you think we just review random movies, we didn't always do that. To hear us gab about each and all of the 123 AFI classics. Most of them are classics. A lot of them. 100 of them? Something like that? Scroll back many years ago on this channel. I'm the fella who converses with volleyballs even when I'm not desperately lonely. Ryan Ellis. Spalding! Well said! And here's the sexy Texan who loves to weld wings and whose mail gave me the inspiration to just keep L-I-V-I-N. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Can you imagine McConaughey in this role? I can. But Hanks is outstanding in this movie. I think we agree on that, right?
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't agree with that?
Yeah. One of the great roles for Tom Hanks. Okay. The elaborate coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. Castaway. What is the biggest number? The total number of Tom Hanks movies adjusted for inflation on the Box Office Mojo Top 200. Or the movies he was in that were nominated for Best Picture. Or the movies we've covered, and I'll include Castaway in that group.
I didn't look this up.
No one did.
Because I love myself.
You have a job.
I have a job. But I will take a stab, and I really thought about this. I couldn't decide whether to go with Best Picture or podcasts we've done, but I decided to go with podcasts.
You're on the right track, but you're wrong.
It was Best Picture?
Yes, but you know what? Until a couple of hours ago when I double-checked my notes, I thought it was a dead heat with all three.
Oh, really?
I thought it was 8 for all three, but it's 9 for Best Picture and 8 for the movies we've covered and for the Box Office Mojo list.
So which Best Picture did you miss?
Toy Story 3.
Oh, yeah!
So here's the list for those who might be interested in all this mumbo-jumbo. The 9 Best Picture nominations in Tom Hanks movies. Forrest Gump, Apollo 13, Saving Private Ryan, The Green Mile, Toy Story 3, Extremely Bad and Incredibly Dumb, Captain Phillips, Extremely Bad and Incredibly, oh my God, why is it in there? Bridge of Spies, and The Post, The 8 Box Office Mojo Movies, 26 for Forrest Gump, 102nd for Toy Story 3, 121st for Toy Story 4, 125th for Toy Story, the first one, 126th, so back to back for Toy Story 2, which I watched last night, by the way, on Disney Plus. I still love that movie. And When Somebody Loved Me, made me cry again. Castaway, this movie, 176th, and Apollo 13, which we covered just a few months ago, 195th, and Hanks produced My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which is 180th.
Oh, we're counting movies he produced.
No, that's a 9th, but I'm just saying he produced it, and that's another one, by the way, but 8 movies he was in. And the 8 that we've covered, I think I've said most of them already, Forrest Gump, Toy Story, Saving Private Ryan, A League of Their Own, Big, Splash, Apollo 13, and now Castaway.
You know what movie I really expected to come up on at least the Best Picture nominee list? Catch Me If You Can. That was never nominated for Best Picture?
No.
What do you know?
Supporting actor Christopher Walken and I believe the music by John Williams, but that's it. A Leo film, Hanks, maybe miscast, but a lot of fun. Haven't seen it in a while, but I kind of want to watch it again, talking about it right now. Robinson Crusoe was released by 20th Century Fox a few weeks shy of 20 years ago on December 22nd, 2000. And interestingly, I double-checked this, it's not on Disney+. There's no four-letter words in this film, no sex, yet they don't have it on their channel. But it's their property now because they own Fox.
It's still a pretty grown-up movie. I would say even though it doesn't have any of those things you just listed, it's pretty grown up. He finds a corpse.
This is part of the problem with Disney buying Fox, is that Fox has such a great roster of films, and some of them are on there, like Home Alone, which we covered just last week, and many of them are not. They're not going to put Die Hard and all of its sequels on there because of all the swearing and the violence. I guess I get that, but how are people going to find Die Hard if they don't already have the Blu-ray or some other means?
So. It's very frustrating that, yeah, they own all these movies.
One company should not own all of Hollywood. But they do.
But don't they want to make money? Why aren't they putting these great titles that are really popular?
Disney After Dark.
We have Disney Plus. I don't care for it. If we were not married, I would not be subscribing to it. There's nothing that interests me because I'm not into kids' film. But if all of those Fox movies were on it, 100%, it would be like a total must-have. I'm a customer that they would be losing because they refuse to put grown-up movies on there.
Yeah, they may be looking to put it in those on in a few months or maybe next year, especially with streaming now being the thing for movies. They've got a lot of subscribers, and they're going to get more probably in the next couple of weeks because they're going to be releasing some big movies that would have been in theaters, but now will only be on Disney Plus. I bet they're probably planning something like that. Maybe it's a section with a certain password so you can't see the diehards of the world and all the blood and guts and violence unless you're an adult.
Or like you said, just make a Disney After Dark. Let me buy the streaming service that does have these movies. And like you say, they're very smart. They obviously know what they're doing. They're the most successful media company, if not in the world, at least in North America. But they do have such a bizarrely puritanical ethos.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well anyway, who knew this movie about a guy alone on an island could be such a monster hit? Although Tom Hanks apparently proposed this movie to Fox, or maybe it was Paramount. I believe they have a stake in this too. He said, I have an idea for a movie about a guy alone for a long time and nothing happens to him. This is an unlikely hit. Bev, you probably should remind people what Castaway is about with the Castaway. Not so Tom Hanks skinny until the end when he's kind of skinny.
Tom Hanks is Chuck Nolan, a man whose job is, as far as I can tell, to yell at people to go faster.
Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock.
Anyway, Chuck is so good at berating slowpokes that FedEx flies him around the world to do it. That is until Chuck's plane goes down in the Pacific and he, the lone survivor, is stranded on an uncharted island where he must find food, water, shelter, and ultimately his own rescue. But he doesn't get rescued in time to stop his fiancée, Helen Hunt's Kelly, from moving on with her life.
Just sit right back and you hear a tale. If you skip the spark plug sponsors at the top of our podcast, go back and give that a shot because I did a Castaway Gilligan's Island thing and maybe it was fun, maybe it wasn't. Or, in a nutshell, ever cried about the loss of some sporting equipment? No? Watch this movie and you might.
You might.
My eyes have gotten misty at times over the Wilson thing. More so the Kelly thing towards the end. But there have been times I watched this movie and the Wilson thing bothered me more, got to me more, than him losing Kelly.
It's when he starts saying, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, my heart. Tom Hanks is a gift to the world.
I said McConaughey earlier jokingly, and a lot of actors probably could have been very good in this role and maybe even as good as him. But I'm not so sure about that. We agree. This is one of the rare movies where the middle section, when he's on that island, is easily the best part of this movie. The first bit and the last bit is fine. The first bit especially, setting everything up and their relationship and all that. Nothing wrong with that at all. The first, whatever it is, 15 or 20 minutes, I forgot about this, and we do this in December. It's a Christmas movie. It is set in December, and it's leading towards Christmas. They have, I think it's supposed to be Christmas Eve, or maybe it's Christmas Day dinner.
She makes him promise that he's going to be home by New Year's Eve.
I'll be right back! As we learned in Scream, never say, I'll be right back! It'll take 4 years. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on Castaway. 88% of critics like this film. 138 fresh, 18 rotten, for an average of 7.3 out of 10, and 84% of audiences. It was second at the 2000 U.S. box office, A Guy Alone on an Island. Second. Anyway, The Grinch, we've talked about it lots of times. We haven't covered it, though, meaning the Jim Carrey one was number one. Gladiator was number four. We covered that earlier this year. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, we covered that, I think, last year, was number 12. And Traffic, the one that probably should have won Best Picture, but Gladiator did, that also got covered this year on this channel, was 15th. This movie only got 2 Oscar nominations for Hanks as Best Actor, and I think he probably should have won, but he had 2 wins already.
Yeah.
And Russell Crowe was due in the eyes of the Academy. But if you look at all of his performances, hard to argue against Forrest Gump, but this might be better, and it's certainly better than what he did in Philadelphia.
How do you pick? This truly is a man who has given us an embarrassment of riches when it comes to best actor-worthy performances.
Only one movie he's ever done, it'd probably have to be Gump for all kinds of reasons. Same director, too, of course. Zemeckis did Forrest Gump and Castaway.
I think his performance in this movie is better than Russell Crowe's performance in Gladiator, which is a fine performance, but this is just a harder performance to pull off in every possible way.
I think we said when we did Gladiator a few months ago was, at least as far as I'm concerned, the fifth best of those nominees. Nothing wrong with it.
But if I was a voting member of the Academy, I probably would hesitate to vote for Hanks for a third Oscar in, like, what, 6 years?
It would have been seven.
That's just a lot. I kind of understand where their heads were at, where they were like, we just got to do something else. Somebody else needs a chance.
Hanks also won the Golden Globe for this movie. He's won four of those. And, of course, he won the Cecil B. DeMille Award earlier this year. That was a pretty emotional speech. He got teary. I tried to watch some of his various speeches. They have a bit of a compilation. He gets teary quite a lot when he wins awards. It's actually pretty sincere, though. I don't think he's faking it. That speech this year at the Globes was about his family.
If that man is faking his persona, he truly is the greatest actor yes. of any generation, because the best thing about him is his bottomless charm.
Mm-hmm. And we've said before that he's the one guy, maybe more than anyone else on the planet, who can never possibly, we want it, he might be, but can never possibly be a villain in any kind of way, especially the Me Too thing, but anything, if we find out he's a secret racist, or if he does drink the blood of babies, and he doesn't. Any of those kinds of things. Not Hanks. I gotta have Hanks. I know a lot of people would have said Cosby, and I get why they would have thought that. And then he let so many people down.
But once we lost Cosby, we were like, we gotta keep Hanks.
Gotta keep Hanks, yeah.
You know, no matter how hard his son tries to muck it up.
Hunter Biden of their family. Well, anyway, this movie's long, but I think the editing was worthy of a nomination, too. I don't know about Best Picture, necessarily, or Best Director, or the screenplay. The sound was a worthy choice because they had such a hard time with that surf. On the commentary, one of the sound guys talks forever about how we couldn't get good sound on scene. We had to recreate it in the studio. It gets a little boring after a while because you hear him say the same thing. And I tip my hat to that, how hard they worked. But I get it. You had a sound issue.
I have pretty bad hearing, as you well know. And I particularly have trouble hearing anything when there's background noise. And I may as well be deaf when I'm next to a surf. I can barely hear anything.
It's probably true of all of us.
It's louder than we think. It's just that it's a din. So it doesn't register as a very loud noise. But yeah, I can see how it would just absolutely ruin every take.
I think about this movie too visually, not just audio-wise with that surf, it's relentless. You forget that sometimes until you see a movie or just in a surf in reality. And the water just keeps crashing. It doesn't care about you. It just keeps coming at you. When he topples over, when he tries to get out to what he thinks is the boat out there early on in the film, and then gets his legs speared by the coral reef, and he's hurt pretty badly in his thigh.
And the waves don't relent.
But the waves just keep on coming at him. So the audio being consistent with that makes sense to what is true in reality, which is the surf never stops. Last plot for Castaway. It was nominated for the top 100 cheers, which of course means most inspiring, I guess, for never giving up hope. Except he admits to Stan in that great wonder at the end of the film when the camera circles Hanks in that long monologue. He did give up hope. I don't blame him, but he wanted to kill himself. I had control over nothing. So this movie is inspirational, but I like how it also finds a way to not be inspirational. Not many movies ever go down the road of, I wanted to kill myself, and tried to.
If he really wanted to kill himself, he could have found a way to kill himself. This time around watching this film, now I've seen it so many times, and I always dwell on why it fails in the end, and I always can't help myself in trying to think, how could you fix this? And I think the first thing I would do if I was in the edit suite is take out that scene that you just described. It tells you nothing that you don't already emotionally understand. There was a moment when he lost hope and he carried on, and he can say, oh, it's because I couldn't kill myself, it wouldn't have worked. You could drown yourself. There's a lot of ways to die. There's a lot of ways to give up. I just thought that it slowed us down, and I know they needed a bridge to get from the scene with Kelly to the crossroads at the end, but the rest of the movie lets us feel what the plot is and what the theme is, and then they just take this big, long, boring break, and they tell us. Literally tell us, and I don't even think it's that helpful. Part of the flaw with the third act is I don't think that they really build up to it in the first two acts. It's almost like they change the direction of the film dramatically when he gets off the island and make it about something else entirely, which is a little bit frustrating because the rest of it is so good.
I remember when this came out, the same year as What Lies Beneath, Zemeckis was shooting this movie with Hanks when he was the chunkier version. And Hanks put on weight, so when he lost the weight, he wasn't Christian Bale and Machinist type small. Of course he's skinny, but compared to what he was in the beginning, where, like me, could stand to lose a few pounds. I could stand to lose more than he could. But Hank's chunked up deliberately so that when he lost the weight, it wasn't so extreme. And he had to be physical for a lot of the performance when he has the long hair and the beard. So they had to be smart about how they did that. Make him fatter first so he's more healthy skinny later. And of course, he's got the long hair and beard too. That was his actual hair and beard. I don't think they even dyed it. I guess Hank's just grows blondish hair in his mid-40s or whatever age he was at this point.
It's ironically that we would call that healthy skinny when it's a man that's starved. A man who's been eating nothing but crab and coconuts for 4 years. There's no way
fish.
He's healthy.
He gets some fish.
Okay, fine. There's no way that's a healthy body compared to...
Of course.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Zemeckis shot What Lies Beneath. And that was also a hit in the same year. Harrison Ford, Michelle Pfeiffer, Zemeckis' film. One of the more forgettable ones. Not that it's bad.
I remember enjoying it a great deal and then never watching it again.
Right. Me too. I don't think I've ever seen it a second time. Although Pfeiffer... Ford's fine, but Pfeiffer, one of her better performances, one of her more underrated performances, but still not as much of a standout as this film is. But still, those two big blockbusters in 1 year. And in both cases, they revealed the twist in the trailer. And Zemeckis was quoted as saying back then, people want to know that he got off the island, and people want to know what Harrison Ford was really up to and what lies beneath. I don't agree, but I do remember very distinctly in Castaway when he's talking with Stan on the FedEx plane at the end when he's been rescued. We buried you. We had a coffin. A coffin. What was in it? And you know for sure he gets rescued. So I get why they did it, but I don't
research
that they did it.
Research shows that people enjoy a movie more.
Which is what Zemeckis said.
I think it really depends on the movie. Some movies are better when you don't know. And some movies I actually have enjoyed much better the second time around in a way because I expect what's going to happen next.
Even though the scenes with Hanks and Hunt in the last act I think are pretty effective. And that teared me up even more than the volleyball did this time. Other times it's been the volleyball or equal or whatever. But this was more effective to me this time, I guess. Maybe because I'm thinking, what if this happened to me or to you? And then we were reunited, but 4 years had passed, so understandably, we moved on, and now we're committed to somebody else. What do you do? And I don't know how you get rid of those scenes, because they do play them pretty well, those two actors, very low-key and everything, and this whole notion of, I had her again, and she's not meaning to do it, but she's teasing me with this kiss. You're the love of my life, but I gotta go home to my husband and kid. And you're right, maybe the scene with Stan is explaining too much, but you have to have that bridge. I think it's a very well-played scene in that long take. Zemeckis is known for doing long takes, big oners. This almost could be a Top 100 Passions nominee. This guy is doing all of this to save his own life, but because he wants to get back to his girlfriend, he's never talking about FedEx. I gotta get back to my job, though that's all he's about. Well, he loves his girlfriend a lot. In the opening part of the movie, in the early part of his life. But he's about getting back to Kelly, and then I don't think he can be shocked that she's moved on. What do you think you would do with the last bit of this movie? Or maybe, and I think even Ebert said this in his review, the movie might be wise to end with him being rescued.
I think I would do that. I would end the movie with him being rescued. It would be like The Martian, which a lot of people have called Castaway in Space. The movie effectively ends when he gets rescued. They have a little bit of an epilogue. But the rescue is the point. He carried on and he survived. Now, I love The Martian. I think it's a great movie. It's super procedural. It relies on momentum a lot. And of course, Matt Damon's charm and charisma carries that movie as well. But I never have the emotional depth that Castaway has. Castaway is such an emotional movie. Part of the problem with this film... They were making their own blueprint. So it's not like you had a formula to start with, because the formulaic version of Castaway would be a man who's rich and only cares about money and is mean to his girlfriend and doesn't understand life at all and needs some perspective, and then he gets cast away on this island and he learns a little thing about life. And when he comes back, she's waiting for him and they're happy and they have a big hug and kiss and you know that he's changed for good. That's the movie that most Hollywood people would make. But Zemeckis, and Hanks in particular, was determined not to make that movie. He wasn't interested in making that movie. He wanted to make a film about a man who is truly changed by the environment. The environment chisels him into something new rather than someone conquering the environment like The Martian, where he overcomes through his own sheer force of will. But it's more like this island chisels this whole new person out of Chuck. The only way that he can survive is by meeting the situation where it is. When he leaves the island, he is a different person, but it's not really a happy ending in the sense that he's not a happier person. He has a different perspective on life, yeah, but he was a happy person before. This is where the movie really stands out. He was happy before. He was a good boyfriend before. He wanted to marry Kelly, and you don't really think that she has a problem with his way of life. Right. She accepts him the way he is.
When I come back from this trip to Moscow, I think he's going back to Moscow. That office is in trouble, I guess, really, because we see it in the beginning. And then I think that's what the whole emergency phone call, when they're having, I guess it's supposed to be Christmas Eve dinner. It's a Christmas meal of some kind, let's put it that way, with his family. And then they're looking at their schedules, and okay, you got to be back for New Year's, like you said earlier. So then he flies away. And I'm not sure if he's going to Russia.
He's going to Malaysia.
Is that what they say?
I didn't quite follow that he was supposed to even be going back to Russia. Because why would you go to Russia via Malaysia? FedEx has planes going everywhere all the time. They would never send you in the opposite direction to get you to Northern Europe.
Well, the reason why I think he must have been going to Moscow again, maybe to fix that office, is because of Bettina's wings package.
Well, this is a reasonably good question I have. A... Why at the end of the film is he delivering packages to people in Texas?
Okay, 2 points. One is, we don't know for sure if the flight that crashes is coming back. And that's Dick Williams. So it's Bettina and Dick on that sign in Texas. And at the end of the movie, it's just, it looks like the Lone Pine Mall thing. It's cut off and it just says Bettina. But we don't know for sure if that's him sending another package back. Their divorce took a long time. If it was, no, sorry, it wasn't 4 years, because when the package is on the plane, it's still 1995. And then, of course, it cuts forward 4 years to 1999. And then the movie got released in 2000. But it looks like it is a package from America going to Moscow again. It could be arguably from Dick back to Bettina. But then why would he send a FedEx package with her wings on it, her insignia, from Moscow? So I'm not really sure. They could be coming back, though, from Moscow when they crash. We don't know for sure. And you said Malaysia. But whatever it is, he maybe had one hell of a long trip. And I read somewhere that FedEx then, and maybe it's been true all this time, flies across the Pacific multiple times a day.
Three times a day.
Yeah. Every single day. Wow. And I'm sure it's even more now than there's more people and more people that send packages and stuff. One of the great touches in this film, and this is one of the things that Hank worked on with Bill Broyles, the writer who wrote Apollo 13, went on to do Jarhead, and since then has mostly written for TV. But one of the things that they wanted to do, especially Hanks, I think, was let's put basically crap in these packages, what looks to be completely useless for someone in Chuck's situation. What's he going to do with ice skates on an island? What's he going to do with a dress. Fancy dress? What's he going to do with videotapes? That's dated, of course, too, videotapes. It wouldn't even be DVDs anymore or Blu-rays. It'd be a PVR or, I don't know, some kind of digital box. But then, of course, he stops when he gets to the, we'll just say it's Bettina's package, because maybe it's not, but it's a Williams package in any case, because it has the wings on it. It's one of the two of them that sent it, and he stops. I love the story. I don't know if you read about this, but I heard about this years ago on the, I think, DVD. Maybe the Blu-ray has it too. But somebody asked Hanks years ago, probably promoting this movie 20 years ago, what was in that package? And he said it was a waterproof solar-powered satellite phone.
FedEx did like a Super Bowl ad.
They did. It's pretty funny. I saw it a week ago.
Oh, yeah. What was in the packages? Oh, you know, a satellite phone, waterproof matches, seeds. Just silly stuff.
That was pretty funny. Yeah, it wasn't Hanks that played the character. It was some guy with a long beard who finally delivers the package. It was pretty good, yeah. And this is, of course, a commercial for FedEx as well, which I don't think I've ever personally used, but...
They didn't pay for it, though. They didn't put any money into it. The writer and Hanks wanted it to be about a courier company, and they wanted it to be FedEx, because I think FedEx then and still is probably the biggest couriers in the world. They approached FedEx and were like, can we please use your stuff? And they didn't pay them. They just let them use their logo, their trucks, their uniforms.
Their CEO, Fred Smith, in this movie.
Is it the party?
Welcoming Chuck back.
FedEx didn't pay a dime, but they did help out with the film. And initially, they kind of had some squeamish feelings about the plane crash. Ultimately, let's face it, it's a huge ad for FedEx. It's incredibly favorable towards FedEx, implying that a FedEx employee would spend 4 years and his motivation for getting rescued was to send this package to somebody.
Well, secondary to finding
his girlfriend. I know, and it's symbolic, of course, but it speaks to his dedication to his job. Another thing that a lesser movie would have had him get over his dedication to his job, but no, that's part of who he is. That is the Chuck of before times that he needs to get back to. But yeah, it's incredibly flattering.
There's two things I want to say about the FedEx thing, because people have criticized that for 20 years since it came out and probably since. One is that when people criticize marketing in movies and they show Coke or Nike or these huge name brands that are just associated with that type of thing, FedEx is what it is for Supermail, if you want to call it that. That's what we know. So when people do the, how dare you have Coke in your movie or Nike, but that's what's on thousands of people's shoes with Nike or in their hands with a can of pop. So it's not like it's unusual or they're trying to force something down our throats. So we see marketing and product placement in movies all the time. And sometimes it's obvious and irritating. Adam Sandler's movies do this a lot. Sometimes it's funny, like in Wayne's World. And other times, like in this movie, it just makes sense. This is the biggest, I just call it the Supermail type of company in the world then, probably now. And they had a plane crash. And then when he sees these packages, he's so diligent, he picks them up because at that point he's thinking, I'm going to be rescued. Well, I got to collect these packages. And as Hanks has said, the minute he starts opening those packages is when he gives up.
Yeah, that's the total.
On a rescue, not on life, but on a rescue. And of course, he finds all these useless things, which was the point with Hanks and Broyles. Let's find things that make no sense for this guy in the middle of nowhere in a tropical island. And then he finds use for, I think, all of it.
One of the appeals of this movie is all the ingenuity. He is a really smart guy, and he figures out all of these ways to engineer his situation to make them work for him, including turning the tool and the dress into a fishing net or turning the ice skates into an axe head.
Which would never last for very long, because as it points out on the internet, they wouldn't even be sharpened being sent like that.
No, he could have found some way to sharpen them against rocks on the island, I guess.
I suppose, and also the other thing about that is that they are a blunt force object, so it might take a lot more whacking. When he gets the smaller shoes from the guy on the plane, who he finds, the body he finds, you said that was a hard scene for Disney to put on their website. Maybe that's why this movie isn't on Disney Plus. But his feet are smaller, so he cuts these openings for his feet, and they're perfectly cut. Even if he had his pocket knife, which unfortunately gave up with his keys to Kelly before he left, or even if he had a great pair of skates, which he didn't at that point, he still wouldn't have a perfectly cut shoe, but we let it slide because we don't really think about that, and I didn't for the first several times I saw this movie.
Really, the most egregious error is that smashing an abscess tooth would help.
Right. It would make it worse.
He would have died of that infection.
And that's, of course, one of the many foreshadowings. He says to Kelly on the phone, he's in Russia, tick-tock, 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 that he's got a pain in his tooth. I got to get this looked at when I get back there. But then there's no time because they go home. They bone. They go to his family dinner. And then he's got to go back to work immediately. That might be a few days, but the movie makes it feel like it's a matter of minutes or hours that all happens, or a day and a half.
So do you think that Jerry, the dentist, gave him a bad root canal, and that is why his tooth was so messed up?
Maybe so.
Jerry, the dentist, who then married his fiancée?
He says he recommended him. I think this is what he says. Isn't it Chris Noth, that brawny man meat, who married Helen Hunt, says something about how I recommended you, I think is what it was?
Oh, I thought he was the guy who gave him the root canal, not his regular dentist. Because he would recognize his regular dentist.
Yeah, that could be. I've had root canals. I've also had my wisdom teeth pulled. And if I saw the dentist or the lovely hygienist, whatever you want to call it, who helped him out that day, I would never recognize them now because I went there once.
But if one of them married me while you were stranded on an island for 4 years?
Screw that guy. This is a very complex movie in the shoot and everything, but it's one of the rare movies that's set in Texas in the beginning. Red Square, for a decent-sized portion in the beginning. Tennessee, which isn't so important, but that's where FedEx is located, I guess, and that's where he's supposed to live with Kelly. And Helen Hunt does have a slight Tennessee accent. I wouldn't really say it comes and goes. It's mediocre at best, but there it is. I don't think Hanks has one, but it could be that he was somebody from Boston or something, or California, that got transferred.
Also, you and I have traveled in the States, and it's surprising how much region to region people have quite a variance in their
accent. The Bostonians really didn't have that Boston accent.
No, but few of them did.
But not that many.
Lots of them didn't.
Yeah. But most of the movie, of course, was set in some island near Cook Islands, is what Kelly says towards the end. And they shot it in Fiji. So primarily the movie is in Fiji in the middle section, which is, of course, the best part. One of the lovely touches, which I didn't really think about until watching it this time, is a puddle on the street where Bettina lives. Well, street, the dirt road, where the Williamses, because she's still married to him, officially live. And there's a big puddle, so it must have recently rained, surrounded by the land of Texas. And that's the opposite in this movie of the island surrounded by an ocean.
I had a professor in film school who always said that he could tell if a movie was going to be good or not by the first shot, or at least the credit sequence, whatever a director chose to do for the credit sequence to him, inform the entire movie. the first shot of this film, it's a long take on a dusty road going one direction, and then the camera does a slow pan to the other side, which is, as you say, the puddle, but it's also the crossroads. Like, mm-hmm. it goes from a direct path with no deviance to a crossroads where you have to make a choice, which is Chuck's journey.
Yeah, and at the end, that's one of the things people have criticized, probably more the last 10 or so minutes, for being so on the nose, because he's at a crossroads and he meets this beautiful young woman who's now single. He doesn't know that, but we do, or we can piece it together that she's available. Maybe not that young, but she's not 50 or 60 or anything. And he's available because Kelly's remarried and he's moving on with his life. And then that little smile at the end of the film. A lot of people were critical of that. I remember in the reviews of this movie in 2000 about how it's this forced smile that he has at the end. Because I think it's supposed to be that he looks all the directions, but then looks back at the camera, which represents Bettina Williams's place. So I'm going to go talk to her. Apparently, Hanks has said his opinion of what would happen next would be he's going back to ask her out and they'd have a lot of babies together. But I do have a what happens next that isn't really about that, though. Chuck becomes a volleyball coach. Just be really nice to the volleyball kids. Okay, come on.
Everyone, smacking it so hard.
Only spike it sometimes and very nicely.
Here's the first rule. Never let your volleyball out of your sight.
Yes. Or he does go back to Bettina's and asks her out for a bottle of water and a little light bump set spike.
My what happens next is less funny. It's more he sells the rights to his life, writes a book, makes $1 million, sells the movie rights, makes $5 million, but spends the rest of his life suffering from some form of PTSD.
Oh, as he should, yeah.
Oh my god. The movie's not really shy about it. You are looking at a man who is messed up from his experience.
He should be.
Yeah, he's sleeping on the floor, and he is really awkward. He's not the same boisterous, fun person he was before. We are criticizing, nitpicking little things that are realistic or not about his life on the island, but I actually find that one of the flaws in the third act is how unrealistic his relationships are. If that happened to somebody, where are his parents, his family? Mm-hmm. You're telling me he has no family?
They seem close during that dinner.
Where are all those people? Why is he sleeping alone in a hotel room? If that happened to you or me or anyone we knew, we wouldn't let those people out of our sight.
Could be his choice.
I guess it could be his choice, but it just feels like he's unrealistically lonely. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people that he would be really super happy to see. Kelly's a big one, and I understand that. The movie just wants to focus that and not introduce so many characters. But his loneliness just feels like a contrivance of the film. He wouldn't be lonely because the press would be calling him nonstop. Yeah. He would just have a barrage of company and entertainments, and he absolutely would have to be the one to be like, okay, that's enough. He has that party with his coworkers, and they're just like, oh, look at the time. It's light outside. And they're like, gotta go. There's a table full of food. And they're like, that's enough.
No crab's legs, yeah, please.
I gotta beat the
no
traffic.
No lobster.
Who's the person planning this party who's like, I want nothing but seafood?
Well, this movie does fit, as did last week's movie Home Alone, with our theme this whole year almost now. I guess for the Asian audience, it has been the whole year. But for the North American audience, it's been most of the year. Well, we're all by ourselves. At least we're married and have two dogs. I feel so bad for those who don't. We know a few people who are living alone. Not that many. Luckily, most of our close relationships are with people that have at least a spouse or at least a roommate. In a lot of cases, a family, kids and all that kind of thing. But this does fit in with the theme of this year, and God knows how much longer this will continue. So I agree with you that it is a little bit weird that they would bail on him, because whenever this ends, I've seen this on Twitter and Facebook so many times. People have said this, one of those trying to get attention type tweets, I guess. What are you going to do first when this ends? And I've seen this more than anything else, more than doing something nuts. It's I'm going to hug my friend, my coworker, my whatever family I can't possibly see right now, as hard as I can for as long as I can.
People can't even make jokes about it. People try to start joke threads on Twitter. No, seriously, I get it. You're going to hug your family. But what are you going to... Are you going to go to the movies? Are you going to travel? I just want to hug my mother. I just miss people. I miss people. I miss going to work. Everyone thinks I'm crazy for saying this, but to hell with working from home. I cannot wait to get back in the office.
Well, shout out to our friend Sarah, who's the best hugger we know, that whenever we can finally do it again, she might break some backbones and ribs and things. She already does that when she hugs now. And
I know. She's going to squeeze us into oblivion, I think.
She says we give good hugs, but she's the best hugger I know. I think I said already, we've got a lot of foreshadowing in this movie. The toothache, the time, tick-tock, 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 and then all he has is time. That's on the nose, but appropriate. The pocket knife that he uses early on, but then would he not give anything to have that? Then I guess it would be called backshadowing when he sees the barbecue lighter at the gathering in the hotel room where he is. What I couldn't have done with this thing for all those years. But then when he learns how to make fire, he doesn't really need that barbecue lighter.
Look at these sissies. They need a lighter to start a fire.
The air got to it! I saw this movie by myself before work. I think it was at noon or something, and I had to work at 3. It's about a 2.5-hour movie. And I remember the fire sequence. I was already in, but I was really in during that. And one of the reasons why was somewhere in there, because you almost always hear the surf, but when he's further up, you don't really hear it so much. So it's a lot quieter. It's a pretty quiet movie in general. The plane crash is very loud, granted, and other things are too. But the movie in general, for its running time, is pretty quiet. And I looked around at one point and thought, and it wasn't a big crowd. Granted, it was a noon audience on a Wednesday or something. But it is like a church in here. It's so quiet. They all feel like I do. I am locked into him just doing stuff. He's like a caveman who's got to discover fire and how to do everything, find shelter. Hanks is the one that said that the most important things in life are food, water, fire, shelter. But the big one that people sometimes forget and that he needs is companionship. And that's, of course, Wilson. And he wishes it was Kelly. If it was him and Kelly on that island, he maybe would have just stayed there. You also need dentistry and a sail, as we learn.
William Broyles did research for the script. He was the screenwriter. And how he came up with the idea for Wilson. Once he was commissioned to write the script, and I think he was in on the project before Zemeckis was. So to do research, he put himself on a beach by himself and spent a week just figuring it out for himself.
All by himself.
Well, he did say that he got lonely really fast and that everything was so much harder than he expected it to be. And on day 3 or 4, because garbage washes up on shore where he was somewhere in the Gulf of California, a volleyball washed ashore. He caught himself talking to it. Bang, there's the idea for Wilson. If there's a person on Earth that thinks they wouldn't talk to a volleyball under those circumstances, they're liars.
One of the reasons why this movie works, and we talked about the editing, and this is about patience more than it is about cuts, but he gets mad when he hurts his hand trying to start the fire with the motion, and he splinters the wood, throws it, he's screaming. It's one of the few times he ever freaks out. And then his bloody hand grabs the volleyball and throws it. But then he calms down and he sees the blood in the volleyball. So, of course, his friend is born out of his blood. Again, on the nose, but I think still effective. But when he finally talks to Wilson, doesn't hear Wilson at first, that's later on. But when he talks to Wilson, he's been doing the thing again for a little while. It's not like immediately he creates this creature out of Wilson. It's soon, granted, but it's not immediate. And that's a credit to Hanks and Zemeckis and Broyles for having the patience. This movie is about patience. It's 2 hours and 20+ minutes long. I don't know that it feels that long, partly because the best part of the movie is the procedural that happens when he's on the island, when he's trying to create fire and creating footwear before he finds the shoes to climb around. He's got to put leaves in his socks so he can just walk around and not break open his feet and everything. And of course, we also learn earlier in the movie, if you pay attention, I didn't see this the first time or two I saw this movie. It shows in the scene where he's come back and he and Kelly are obviously upstairs getting reacquainted that he knows how to sail. And that's what he knows about. I forget what you call that thing, but he's created the little graph type deal, the X type thing that shows dates, months, and that kind of thing. Explain it to Wilson.
It's like a sundial, kind of.
Okay, and that's how he knows he needs to start sailing. I think it's in the spring to get picked up on the travel routes by the big boats. Because if he didn't know that, then how would he ever know when to leave the island or how would he... Well, maybe somebody could figure out a sail, but he needs to know these things and the movie's smart about that. It isn't on the nose. It's one of the few subtle things, though, because I remember not really dwelling on it, but later on realizing, how did he know these things? And then you read later, oh, because it shows that he has been a sailor anyway. Just coincidentally, he was into sailing. He's not regatta man, but he's able to get by with this and then he learns a lot more because he has to out of necessity. One of the more important things in that flight where he crashes, and that again, great example I said a minute ago about how quiet and patient this movie is, that maybe could have been shortened a little bit, but they really draw it out where he gets out of his seat to wash up. We don't know why he has a Band-Aid. Doesn't really even matter. I guess the idea is, oh, my finger hurts, but guess what, Chuck? That's nothing compared to what you're about to go through. And it's getting out of his seat to get Kelly's watch when he is strapped in, when the plane is looking like it might go down or something bad's about to happen, that saves his life. Because only he and I think it's Alan or Albert. He gets the name wrong, too, and now I'm getting the name wrong.
It's Albert.
Okay, Albert. that washes ashore, they're the only ones that aren't on the plane and go down whatever it is, hundreds of thousands of feet. Yeah. Right. So that plane is never going to be found again, maybe by aliens, I guess. But if he didn't get out of his seat, he would have died too, even though he goes through this horrible experience. And what a vivid, scary crash. But had he not gotten out of his seat, he would have died.
The plane crash scene is some of the best action in any movie that's ever been made. If I were a director and I needed to shoot a plane crash, I would study this scene. It's like this incredible exercise in perspective because we see it all from his point of view very strictly. I know we've praised him so much, but just the look on his face when he sees the ground approaching at this alarming pace. That's what I mean. When he realizes just how much trouble they're in, and it's actually shock more than horror. It's this incredibly authentic expression.
I have to get back home for New Year's. How can this be?
Yeah. I've talked before about how I was in a very terrible car accident when I was 21 years old. I was in shock and ambulance drivers pulling me out of the car. I broke my sternum. I was in tremendous pain. There was no question that I had been in a very bad car accident. And all I cared about was, you have to call my dad. I'm not there yet. He's going to be worried. He should be worried. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't settle down until somebody was like, where's your cell phone? I'm going to find your dad's phone number. I'm going to call him. I'm going to tell him what happened. I was like, oh, thank God. Not thinking, you're going to tell my dad that his daughter was just almost killed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. Your priorities are way out of whack in that moment. And you cannot readjust your worldview to accommodate something that tragic and major.
Well, it's one of the great plane crash sequences that's ever been shot. Not his point of view literally with the camera, but we're with Chuck almost the entire time. And we see humongous waves during that storm after they've crashed. It's very similar to the final scene in The Perfect Storm, which was also in 2000, the George Clooney movie, which was a big hit that same year, with those enormous waves that eventually, spoiler alert on Perfect Storm, kill every single person on that boat because they start going up this wave. Hell, it's on the poster of the movie. Clooney and
also,
Wahlberg
it was a true story.
Yes. And Clooney and Wahlberg go up this, I don't know how many stories high that wave is. It's not that much different in Castaway, how big the waves are. And then I remember so well, again, in the theater where you're thinking, I'm by myself here at this point. It's so quiet when you can get past the sound of the movie and just hear him floating around and then as the raft hits the coral, surf, whatever you call it, of the island, lightning, very smart touch too. You briefly see glimpses of the island. We see that peak where he's going to try to kill himself later on, hanging that fake body thing.
I've seen this movie like 3 times this year because it's always on television. And you were sitting with me this week watching it, and I was edge of my seat, gasping, freaking out. But it is just so effective. I feel like I could watch it every day and still be wondering if he's going to make it.
If you could make it work that it's just the movie on the island, and then it ends, golly, the hand reaching out to this gigantic boat in the background and his hand in the foreground. You can't end the movie that way, granted, but if you could make it be that way, that would be an Academy Award winning film, I think, right there.
You would have to rewrite the first act mm-hmm. to get to that moment as an ending, but it would have been a better movie. I agree.
So as much as Chuck loves Kelly, and they do sell that pretty well, Hanks and Hunt working together, she hadn't made a movie in 3 years, since she won the Oscar for As Good As It Gets, and of course she's probably even better known for Mad About You, where she won Emmys, I believe. But then she made 4 in 2000, and maybe they were shot. Well, this one was a long shoot because of the break. But she released this and What Women Want. She's in that with Mel Gibson, another big hit. She was in Pay It Forward. Terrible. And she's also in Dr. T and the Women, an Altman film. So a big year in 2000 for Helen Hunt. Not the greatest actress of all time, and looking back, as much as I really like, maybe even love As Good As It Gets, I don't know if she should have won the Oscar for that. No, she probably shouldn't have. But she's good in that film. And she's good in this film. And I do believe that this guy wants to get back to this woman so badly.
Their chemistry is very believable.
For a brief amount of screen time, for sure. But his real love in the movie, of course, is Wilson. But it's funny because Wilson seems like a nag, a cynic, combative, from what we hear Chuck saying to him. We never hear Wilson speak, which is very smart. Just like Hank said, let's cut a lot of dialogue that Chuck has. Ooh, the sand is so hot is one thing he talked about. Who cares? When he says, hello, one of the great sound designs is it doesn't echo, of course, because why would it echo? It just dissolves. That sound, he first says hello. Who could even hear him?
Who could hear him over the coconuts smashing to the ground? As soon as he figures out what that noise is, we never hear it again.
True, yeah. Because it scares him, so it's to scare us, I guess, too. But Wilson is his, not romantic interest, obviously, but his best friend for going on 4 years. Maybe the closest friend he ever had. he gets along with Stan, Nick Searcy, quite well. But then early on in the movie, when we find out that Stan has a dying wife, very deliberately, the camera, I wouldn't say zooms, but it focuses on Chuck, who doesn't know what to say.
Yeah, he's awkward.
I don't blame him. I don't know what I would say either, necessarily, to somebody who's going through this. The stewardess on the plane is very sympathetic, and she knows these FedEx people, as Fred Smith says towards the end, do seem like a family because they really know about each other.
She's the co-pilot. Sexist. There's no stewardess on a FedEx flight. Why would there be a stewardess on a flight like that?
Okay, fair. But then there's three different people with Chuck and the big flight that crashes.
Yeah, but no one's serving him drinks.
Okay, fine. You're right. Okay. Stewardess is wrong, man. But an employee of FedEx, whatever her job is, if she's a co-pilot, fine. But she knows Stan. She's sympathetic and she's being real human with him. Maybe they're not even friends, but Stan and Chuck seem to be friends. And yet Chuck doesn't know what to say. And then towards the end when he comes back, I'm so sorry I wasn't there for you and Mary.
He does know what to say in that moment.
And he's apologizing for something that he had no control over, too. When my cousin's father died, I called him or texted him, I forget what it was at that point, and said, really sorry about your dad. And his response was, I don't think he meant to be cold, but his response was something like, not your fault. I know, but isn't this what people say?
He doesn't know what to say either.
I'm not good at that thing either, so yeah. I do understand Chuck's view on that.
I heard that once you personally experience a loss, you get better at coping with it with other people.
Which is one reason why Joe Biden might make a very sympathetic and even good president.
Agreed, but Chuck has lost a lot. He lost 4 years of his life. He lost his fiance. So when he then comes back to his friend Stan and says, I'm so sorry about your wife, it's coming from a place of empathy. Whereas before, it just made him uncomfortable because it's scary. And of course, Chuck is probably going to have three different kinds of skin cancer.
Maybe so, yeah.
So maybe he wants all of Stan's doctor's numbers.
But Wilson is his best friend. I said a minute ago, a nag, a cynic, all that. And that's just based on what Chuck says. And is it maybe his own Harvey? Harvey. We said in Harvey that, of course, people always compare Jimmy Stewart, Tom Hanks. And I thought maybe if they ever did Harvey again, that Hanks might not be the best casting for that. Maybe Jim Carrey, Kevin Kline, Donald Glover, all better choices than Hanks in some ways.
But is Hanks this... is that generation's Jimmy Stewart.
That's the cliche. So is this his Harvey then in a way? The volleyball's real, but it talking to him is not. But he has conversations and apparently they wrote dialogue for maybe some off-camera person to say. So it did feel more natural when he said, I know, I'd rather go out there and die than live here talking to some volleyball. And you could do that if you're a great actor. I always get mad when people say, oh, you act against a green screen, or Ian McKellen, who's one of the great actors we've ever seen. I almost had a breakdown doing The Hobbit, working against no one of those green screens. And I'm sure that's tough, but use your imagination. Isn't that what you're paid for? But Hanks, at least, was able to make this work better by having an actual volleyball. And I guess somebody saying the lines off camera. And we know what he's hearing because of the way he reacts.
Well, the movie's all about the perseverance of hope. Wilson is his best friend and the naysayer. And when he's arguing with Wilson, he's arguing with the naysayer in his own head. It reminds me of, and I always get on your case about this, because like most annoying dog people, we talk as our dogs to each other all the time.
We do.
And whenever you're talking as the dogs hate you.
it amuses me.
And they're so mean to you. And they pick on you so bad. And I'm like, why are you so mean to yourself?
Because it makes me laugh.
It makes you laugh. But I do wonder if there's the way that we have to externalize our inner critic.
Maybe.
And so that's how he goes. And this is Dr. Freud here.
Well, it's been a little over 2 years since we had to put Fox down, and I think the last thing he ever saw was my face, because I was facing him. You were a little bit behind him, and my joke has been for so long, is it you murdered me?
It was you!
You stuck a thing in my bum and had me killed!
Oh, dear, you are.
And this movie was released by 20th Century Fox!
So mean to yourself!
That's funny. I'm the Roger Rabbit, calling back to Zemeckis' movie from long before. When he pulls his hand out of the handcuffs. Why didn't you do that before? Because then it wouldn't have been funny.
Man, Zemeckis really made some great movies.
You said this recently on, I forget what the podcast was, what the movie was, but how Zemeckis makes watchable movies almost all the time. With the Uncanny Valley exception. Polar Express will get watched a lot this month because it's a Christmas movie and it's not awful, but I've seen it once, maybe twice, and that's enough. I did like the Jim Carrey Scrooge he did not as much as the other Scrooge versions, Muppet Christmas Carol or the Alistair Sim version, but I think that was pretty good. Jim Carrey is such a great actor. I think he made that work. But the other ones just seem like, this guy's too talented. Why are you wasting your time with this stuff?
He obviously loves special effects. That drives his passion, but it's a shame because his real gift, he's great at special effects, don't get me wrong, but his real gift is storytelling and emotionally
character.
A character. Yeah, I was going to say emotionally engaging with the audience. We talk about Forrest Gump all the time. We agree that it's in many ways a bad movie, but I love it and I am fully invested in every frame. It has all these aspects of it that I am positively allergic to in other movies, but I just don't care. It all goes out the window.
When he says, I miss you, Jedi.
I can't be critical about that movie. It just wins me over. And you're right, it's about character because he makes lead characters that are so lovable that you just root for from the first frame and you never lose that passion for them. That is his gift.
We care about the volleyball in Castaway because he cares about the volleyball.
We care about all of the little things that happen on that island. You know, an hour of him starting fires and wrapping wounds because we care about Chuck. Mm. Now, of course, a lot of that has to do with Hanks. But Hanks has made plenty of bombs. He's made plenty of movies about characters that he's played that nobody cares about.
Yeah.
That nobody watched a second time and we would just as soon forget. And he would be the first to admit he has a few bad runs. What has he done for us lately? When's the last time he made a film we loved? When's the last time we met a Hanks character that we fell in love with, like Chuck?
Mr. Rogers would be that for a lot of people.
I disagree. I hated him in that movie.
For a lot of people, though, that would be it, I think.
People talked about the movie when it came out, and then it really just left the zeitgeist. As soon as some better movies came out, people more or less forgot all about it.
And the documentary is better as well. That was a year or two before. Well, I mentioned the Best Picture nominees for Hanks. He went Green Mile after that really good decade in the 90s. So in about 5 years, so many hits. But just the Best Picture nominees. Forget the great movies like Toy Story that didn't get nominated. Or even I Love That Thing You Do, which he, of course, wrote and directed and starred in or co-starred in, Hanks did. But Gump, Apollo 13, Saving Private Ryan, and The Green Mile in about 5 years all got nominated for Best Picture. But then a movie of his didn't get nominated again for over 10 years, Toy Story 3. And even in that, he's not on screen. He's a voiceover. Extremely bad, incredibly done, terrible. Captain Phillips, I do like a lot. Bridge of Spies and The Post, we don't like a lot. So even some of the movies that are acclaimed are not that good. Because even one of the great actors of the modern era that everybody loves, well, most people love, now he said to people a few months ago, wear a mask. Screw you, Tom Hanks. Don't tell me what to do. I don't like you anymore. Okay, fine, you idiots. But one of the least polarizing actors of all time, everyone seems to love him, still has plenty of mediocre to bad films in his resume. But when Hanks and Zemeckis get together, Forrest Gump and Castaway especially, Polar Express Hanks is in, but of course it's that Uncanny Valley thing. He's playing multiple characters, in fact. But when they got together at least two times, it's two movies that shouldn't have been successful. They could have been watchable and we could be talking about them in a podcast and it'd be fine. But Forrest Gump, it is his biggest hit, Hanks' biggest hit. And Castaway is on his list too, like I said earlier. And the best movie of Zemeckis' career, and one of our favorite movies ever, is Back to the Future. And probably mostly because of the excellent characters.
Marty McFly, a character everybody knows and loves, played by an actor who has charisma to burn, and yet his career really flamed out.
Parkinson's is part of the reason why.
Even before Parkinson's became a factor, and he still worked many years with Parkinson's, but even before that became a factor, what was he doing? Spin City? Was that his claim to fame? The most charismatic actor still needs a director who knows what to do, who knows how to make a character. If you don't have a character that I love, then you can put the most charismatic actor in the world in it, and you get The Terminal.
But as for the Wilson thing, you've seen this movie a lot of times too. Has the Wilson death, if you will, floating off, ever gotten to you? It maybe drags on a little bit too long in a way. But when he jumps off the raft, and he's obviously not the strongest guy at this point, he's been floating for however long and living on not very good food for years, but then he can't pull the raft. Of course, he still has his oars, but he's not thinking clearly to go get Wilson.
He wouldn't have gotten with the oars either.
I'm
he's
sorry,
slower with the oars anyway.
It's floating off on its own. I know I've teared up, if not flat out shed tears of that scene before. Have you?
I don't remember if I've cried, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that I had. It gets me every time. And I'm a person who watches Titanic and is like, oh, Rose, get in the lifeboat with your mother. Leave Jack behind. I need to be won over when it comes to that level of sentiment, when it comes to people versus here an inanimate object, the world's most beloved inanimate object, granted.
Wilson!
But it's so well done because Wilson is always just out of his grasp. When he loses his grip on the string and you know that he has to choose between his imaginary friend and himself, and you're like, you can get Wilson. Come on, just swim. You can do it. Kick your legs.
So they both would die.
Of course. Well, yeah. Wilson is an inanimate object.
In a way, this is
he is dead.
This is a worse scene where I will go into no man's land, try to get you out of there, but the Germans are going to pop out and blow my head off. And then you're going to bleed out anyway.
My point is that I care so much.
Oh, I do too. I'm not criticizing the scene at all. I'm just saying that that's the logic of it when you watch it objectively. And I've seen this movie so many times and that scene so many times. That's all I'm saying is that in the moment, the music helps. We don't hear any score by Alan Silvestri until he gets off the island, which I did not notice until it was pointed out to me. Or maybe I noticed it later on. Anyway, first time you see the movie, well, the trailer, I'm pretty sure, has music when he spears the fish 4 years later. But the movie, no. When he spears that fish and he's lost all the weight, he's grown the long beard and hair, there's no sound of any kind other than just diegetic sound in that scene. You only hear the music when he finally escapes the island by getting that sail from the bathroom door off of an airplane. Maybe his airplane, for all we know. Probably not. It's been 4 years.
Plus, I think it has a bunch of Asian alphabet writing there you go. On it.
So it's some other plane. Another plane crash. Oh, God. Other people probably died then.
It's just...
It's not his plane, probably.
Could have flown off a boat. Could have come from any number of things.
Maybe other people have died. But that's what I'm saying is that just objectively, it's the right thing to do for him not to try to get this volleyball. But of course, you die for him because I want to save my buddy in war times, but I can't. And of course, Saving Private Ryan was only 2 years before this, when they had to make some brutal decisions to try to save as many people as possible. And he has the conversations more than one with Sizemore about what's the best thing for the company, but people will die. And Wilson is Caparzo. He's Vin Diesel or one of the other guys. He's Tom Sizemore. I want to get everybody out of here and get us all back to safety. Three things that matter: my life, Wilson's life, and this package. The package is securely tied. I think Wilson, by the way, commits suicide. Because Wilson's bobbing and bobbing and bobbing. He's been tied very nicely by the videotape, but then he just floats off on his own.
Okay, here's my
Or her own. Maybe it's a her.
Maybe Wilson's a lady. Did we ever think of that? His wife's name, Tom Hanks's wife's name, is Rita Wilson.
Wilson.
So Wilson, of course, is symbolically himself, talking to himself. It's also the coping mechanism that he used to survive 4 years alone on the island. When he loses Wilson, he loses his attachment to the person he had to become to survive. Like everything else, he needs to move on from whatever coping mechanisms he used there. And he has to move on from whatever got him through his life before he went on the island. Mm-hmm. He has to make a whole brand new person when he gets to dry land.
Now he'll be tick-tock. Tick.
In a way,
TikTok.
To make the movie they wanted to make, I wonder if it would have been served better if all the island stuff was trimmed right down. Of course, I never would because it's the best part of the movie. It's so good and I would never want it to not exist. But you could make a movie about essentially the third act of this film that could be so interesting about a person moving on from a trauma like that. Mm. Instead of making that movie, they just tried to sneak that whole journey into the last act of the film. By the way, one of the prop Wilsons sold at auction for like $19,000 or something.
Really?
And it sold to a CEO of FedEx.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
That's fitting. But at the end, when he goes to Texas to finally deliver that package, I guess it's the song is saying, "Return to Sender." So Bettina has sent this to, I guess, Moscow to Dick, who's got his whore, whatever, horse on
there, maybe.
Well, he was married, so he was cheating. And
well,
she's cute, but
maybe they already split up and that's his new girlfriend. He's moving on. They're getting most couples don't sign divorce papers until they're over their marriage.
But Laurie White, whatever her name is, only made 4 movies. She's a country singer. She plays Bettina. And when you see the young girl, I think she's pretty young, in Moscow with Dick, and you see Bettina, the very first person I think in the whole film you see, he made the wrong choice. Just purely looks wise. She is a babe. But yeah, there's a lot of heavy-handed stuff going on at the end. The wings of an angel is what saved him. Of course, he paints the wings on the bathroom door, but then the sail goes flying away. There's one of the dialogue scenes that isn't really explained, what Wilson's saying, which is when there's the big storm and now it's not really even sail. It's more of a boathouse for him. but it gets ripped off and flies away in one of these really bad storms. He's risking that, of course. He may get off the island, but he might die on the sea. But he says something like, I don't know why. And it makes you wonder, what did he hear Wilson saying? Why did we come out here? Why did the sail fly away? What did Wilson say in that moment? And that part is not obvious. But most of what Wilson says, we can figure out. That one I'm not so sure about. And I like that.
Yeah, it could have multiple meanings. Did you not tie it strong enough? I don't know why. I didn't know what went wrong. Or it could be, why did we leave the island at all? We were safe.
You're right. Didn't tie it strong enough, because I think it's the next scene, or soon after at least, when Wilson is bobbing and bobbing and bobbing and falls. And if Wilson was tied better, and Wilson seemed to be tied pretty well, but if Wilson was tied better, if he secured Wilson every single day, however many days he's out in the open ocean, then Wilson would never have fallen off. Can you imagine if those, whatever they are, Chinese boaters and that gigantic freighter had found him with the volleyball, just the package alone, they might have thought, what's going on? You also have a FedEx package with you? We know what that is, but okay. Why does that matter at all? I must have this with me. But if he'd also still had Wilson, I'm taking the volleyball too. I get the package, I guess, but the volleyball that you've put hair onto and a face? Why do you care about this? I always remember Richard Roper said when he and Ebert were on Leno or something, Letterman maybe it was, Chicken Run had come out. I love Chicken Run. It's so funny and so cute. And Roper didn't like it. He said something about how I can't connect with a chicken because I want to eat it or something like that. And I thought, any what? Movie can be good and you can connect with any character that anybody's ever created if it's done right. And this movie, that same year, ironically, is Exhibit A. Who cares about a volleyball? But when you watch Castaway, you do. And I connected with chickens also, which I love eating. Probably the best meat of all time. Certainly the most versatile. Because they make you care in Chicken Run also.
Yeah, that's a stupid thing for Roper to say. Mm. You know that movies can make you feel for
that's their job.
Just about anything.
So there's connections with that commercial that FedEx put out there. Look for that on YouTube. That's really fun. Gilligan's Island, which he actually mentions at one point in the movie itself. And I did the spark plug sponsor at the top. Survivor, one of your favorite shows, I think came out of this movie or was inspired
no,
by
it. No, it was released before Castaway came out.
Really?
It beat Castaway by a few months and then it was a massive phenomenon. They were worried. Oh my God, they stole our thunder. But Hanks was like, our movie's different and our movie's good. So people are going to get past it. And he mentioned in this interview I read that when Big came out, it was like the fourth body switching movie to come out in a few years. Nobody remembers the rest of them.
That's true.
They only remember Big because it was the best one. So he was like, yeah, okay, we're competing with Survivor, but we're great. It's going to stand on its own merits. And he was right. In a way, it may have helped because people had Survivor fever.
Right.
Myself included. I truly am obsessed with that show.
I think you're right. That may have helped more than anything else. And then Lost, one of my favorite shows of all time. Lost.
Well, Lost
was 2004.
The Lost came from a Castaway the TV show project that they wanted to turn into a TV show. And the script got tossed around in this studio and that studio and this creator, that creator. And then eventually it kind of morphed into the show that became Lost.
Robert Redford in All Is Lost, his whole arc, he's on the water the whole time, but it's very similar. And you love that movie in 2013.
I love All Is Lost.
We talked in 2013. We covered something and we said about how that was such a good year for best actor nominees that they didn't find room for Redford in All Is Lost or Hanks in Captain Phillips with one of the best scenes, maybe the best scene he's ever played at the end of Captain Phillips.
Wasn't he nominated for best actor?
Neither of them were.
There's truly one scene in Captain Phillips that he ought to get.
Oh,
through.
He's good in the whole movie.
He's good in the whole movie, but that scene at the end is, oh my God.
Ruins me. I've watched it many times
incredible.
On YouTube. It is devastating. And it's also plays into this movie. It has nothing to do with this movie, literally, but it calls back to this movie. One thing I do think is a bit of a mistake by Zemeckis is that when Hanks is crying over Wilson being gone, you hear the crying as the camera's panning over this wide shot of an ocean. I'm sure it's a visual effect of him being in a tank. There's a lot of tank work. And the movie, of course, and then visual effects help make it look like he's out in the open ocean. But you hear him crying, and the camera goes over him. The music at that point is over the top. Silvestri's music is really big and loud then. And I remember thinking that it just panned over, skated past the shot. You hear him crying, you know what's going on, and that's it. But no, the camera goes right in on him, and I think that's a mistake. You don't need to do that. We know he's upset. Hearing him crying is enough. Seeing it with some big wide shot would be enough, but they have to go big and close, and maybe that's, oh, it's his big Oscar moment. Although the scene with Stan is probably the big Oscar moment in a way.
It's like Zemeckis had so much trust in the audience for so much of the film, but every once in a while he chickened out and really spoon-fed it to us.
Well, Spielberg's his mentor, and he does that a lot too.
Spielberg just does that as a rule. It's true, though. He doesn't really make us work for it ever.
And this movie continues Hanks' trend of being alone in so many movies. He has to go through some serious trauma and he's trying to get back home. And we've covered that in so many films, Apollo 13 especially, Saving Private Ryan's about that. Forrest Gump, a lot of the time, is about that. The number of times he's out on his own in some bad situations and has to get home. The Toy Story,
I was going to say, yeah, can't
And we
can
keep going on. Captain Phillips, of course, as well. So the technical people, the cinematographer Don Burgess shot a 1.85:1 movie on Blu-ray. We watched that. It looked pretty good. He shot Forrest Gump, also Spider-Man. He was Zemeckis' guy for many films, and then not so much anymore, but for a long time he was his cinematographer. There's quite a bit of day for night in this movie, and it could just be a post-production effect, but if it is actually day for night, and I'm not sure it is, I didn't look it up, it's come a long way since the 50s movies we covered at the Top 100 Project, like, what's the one in Hawaii? I can't think of the name of it. From Here to Eternity.
Oh my God, it's just day for day. Mm-hmm. They just tell you it's night, and you take their word for it.
Right. This does seem more convincing that way. But one of the things that Hank said, too, is that creating the fire, that's such a great scene, I've made fire! Which, of course, is in the trailer, too. One of the reasons why that's important, of course, is to make food, but it's also so he can stay up at night. He doesn't have to go to bed when it's dark.
It's also a signal. Doesn't the fire scene happen after he sees the ship, and he has no way to signal the ship in the distance, so he thinks, well, if I have fire, then I
That's
can get their attention.
That's part of why he creates it, but it's also so he has a bit of warmth, although he seems like he's warm enough all the time. It's more for food.
Sure. I mean, there's lots of great reasons to have a fire. You can,
and
you
never know,
boil
the fire
your water.
Could be noticed by a passing plane.
Yeah.
But the Pacific Ocean is far and away the biggest desert on this planet. And yeah, no wonder a plane didn't find you. Kelly talks about how they searched for weeks and couldn't find you. But then he says about how they were blown way off course by that bad storm. And then they crashed. Mm-hmm. So they're not where they should be anyway. So no wonder no plane ever found him. And a little fire, if they're looking, I don't know how many miles away would be before they ever actually see that. No wonder they didn't find him because he's so far, of course, where he crashed.
So I just want to circle back briefly to the cinematographer because he clearly is the cinematographer that can work well with special effects, because Castaway is one of those movies, actually a very early example of a movie that has a ton of special effects.
But subtle.
That are subtle, that are blended. Forrest Gump also, although a little more obvious because we know that there's no shot of Forrest Gump talking to JFK.
Listen to the Contact commentary for subtle visual effects. Ken Ralston talks about them so much in Contact.
You talked about the scene where Chuck climbs to the top of that mountain on the island and he's overlooking. That was shot on an abandoned building roof.
Parking lot or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All of that is visual effects. Not so surprising now in 2020, but in the year 2000, that was actually outstanding for its seamlessness.
Artie Schmidt, who won 2 Oscars for Forrest Gump and Roger Rabbit, which we've covered. Both of those are in the archives. And he was Zemeckis' editor until Castaway. I don't know why they stopped working together, but this was the last movie that they ever worked together on. And I said earlier, I think this movie could have been nominated for the editing despite its length. But that would be, of course, for the island stuff, partly because of just the fact that something happens and then start cut. Like, for example, kill a fish 4 years later, no music, there's storytelling right there. Although you said you don't think that needs to say 4 years later.
No. I guess because it's been 4 years, I would have assumed seeing that maybe been a year or two. I feel like they could have worked it into some dialogue with Wilson or something, but whatever. I'm not going to fight it. I'm not mad that they put the title in there, but I think it would have been way better to put the title after you see him. He kills the fish. You zoom up. He's lost 50 pounds. His beard is longer than Moses. And he's clearly, even just by his performance alone, a different person. And then you say 4 years later. I want to be shocked by his appearance first, but whatever. That's such a total nitpick. I wouldn't necessarily rave about the editing in this film. I will. It's great. Zemeckis is such a good technical director, and this is no exception. But the thing that always stands out to me is the sound editing. You know, we've talked about the surf, how they had to re-record everything. But more than that, the soundscape that they create without music creates so much drama on its own, whether it's the sound of the coconuts or the surf. You're so immersed in Chuck's world, and so much of that has to do with the audio. Even in the first act of the film, which is so dramatically different, Zemeckis made such great choices to keep him always crowded. There's always people in his face. There's noises. There's traffic. The world around
him.
That
Christmas dinner is surrounded.
And they're shoulder to shoulder. And they're happy. And there's love. So much warmth.
Fast conversation.
People talk about the island stuff, but there's so much that goes into the world they create before he goes away. The set tech nobody will notice it because they'll be like, every set was so ugly. But it was so intentionally ugly. The banality of his world, of the planes that he's in, oh, the office buildings he's in, the warehouses, the cars, his clothes, everything is so ugly. And of course, that is just a contrast with the beauty, the severity of that island to just make them as different as possible. But they create this real world and you are so immersed. The place he goes to at the airport, at the FedEx Center, he meets Chris Noth. It is the ugliest room I've ever seen with their gray carpet and the foosball table.
Games room.
Everything about that room, low ceilings, drop ceilings. It's just hideous. This is where this man ended up. It's just not the happy ending that any of us expected. It's not what he missed about the world at all. And then, of course, this stranger comes in and tells him, "Ugh, I'm married to your fiance." Ugh.
And the key moment there is that he sees Kelly breaking down and outside. "I have to go see him after all," is what she seems to be saying, or at least implying. And I don't think Chris Noth is played as a bad guy at all. It's not his fault.
No.
But he's probably had a conversation with her before, effectively saying, "No, you can't do it." But she basically collapses in his arms and gets pushed back into the car. And that sounds worse than it's intended. I think if people have seen this movie, they know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But that's why Chuck goes to deliver the watch. He does want that watch to be in her family because he thinks it should be in her family because she gave it to him, but he's not in her family. But it's an excuse, though, too. And then she gives him the car, of course. And the opening part of this movie and the closing part of this movie are fine. They're even very good. But compared to this 12 out of 10 or 15 out of 10 middle section, they're just not as great. And the last shot is, as people have said, I agree with them, forced, the half smile thing. I don't know how else you end the movie, but I wouldn't do it that way.
But I guess my point when it comes to Zemeckis as a technical director is that everything he does in the first and the third act of the film helps make the second act better. The first act in particular, everything he builds up about the world that Chuck lives in, there's such a dramatic contrast to...
I think most of Zemeckis' movies are about a person trying to get back to somebody they love or find somebody they once loved. Even in Contact, her dad's dead, but that's who she meets in this weird millisecond type vision she seems to have in that film. Marty's trying to get back to Jennifer in all three movies. Forrest and Jenny, she doesn't even want to be with him, but that's what he's always driven by. This movie with Kelly, the more recent ones, not as much. But then Zemeckis has made human movies again after the Uncanny Valley stuff with Flight, which I haven't seen a second time, was pretty solid, though. Also some great effects in that when the plane crash happens. And The Walk, which I wish I had seen on the big screen. I didn't pay for it, but if you're going to watch the Man on Wire story, you should watch that on the IMAX screen and be, "Oh my God, I'm going to fall and die." Even those you get wrapped up in enough. And then the best ones. Well, geez, if I had to pick my very favorite must-have movie, I've been thinking about this. My favorite movies, Jaws, Wonderful Life, Citizen Kane, Apocalypse Now. But if somebody said, "You can't have any of those, you get one movie and somehow you can see this movie on a desert island," it might be Back to the Future.
Really?
Yeah.
Back to the Future was my favorite movie.
Because you talk about
from when I was
loving.
It came out when I was 7 until I was like 12.
You talk about loving a movie? Yeah, maybe even more so than those other ones. Although I'll be watching Wonderful Life very soon. Anyway, Zemeckis has made many movies that I have truly loved. Okay, last thoughts on Castaway, which is a bit of a Christmas movie.
There's so much more good than bad here. It deserves a lot of credit for really creating its own blueprint and making something that's original. And if it had just stuck the landing, it would be a masterpiece.
That's why I said last week it's a near masterpiece.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think they really make you care about a piece of sports equipment, which is unbelievable, but that's movies for you. And the last act does have some good emotion with Hunt. You're the love of my life. Some of that stuff does pay off pretty well. But it is the rare movie where the middle act is the best part of the whole film. And like you've said, we've seen this on TV in whole or in part, really usually in part, many times over, and it's hard to turn away. I think one time it was near the end, or maybe it was at the end, and you wanted to go to bed, and you thought, "I'll give it another 10 or 15 minutes. And I didn't this time, but I have had my eyes rain over the volleyball and over him losing Kelly. Lost her all over again. Okay, in 7 days, we'll cover our third straight movie set at Christmas, only this one, unlike Castaway, is a bona fide Christmas movie. It's the savage, sometimes gross, also fun, Gremlins, which I haven't watched in quite a long time.
Me neither.
The coming attractions trivia for Gremlins. It's trivia again. How about that? Joe Dante is best known for making campy horror movies like Piranha, The Howling, and the two Gremlins flicks. Which of his horror comedies got the best reviews from Rotten Tomatoes audiences? And what's the best audience-reviewed movie of Dante's on Rotten Tomatoes?
All right, so for the answer to that, check out next week's podcast about Gremlins. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen to us. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and/or 07 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles. Perhaps in exchange for all this great content, you could leave us a rating and a review. If you want to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the U.S.
Or an island in Fiji.
Please go to sparkplugcoffee.com. And use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
You Fijians probably shouldn't actually order it from
No.
That's asking a lot.
Caveat, does not actually deliver to Fiji.
Well, we should go to Chuck's Island. In fact, let's live there.
We'll rent a start.
What a rare mood I'm in. It's almost like being in love with a volleyball. And to a lesser extent, a blonde woman in Tennessee.
And cut.